Hitler and the Nazis have been demonized. They've been described as a gang of criminals. And of course, what they did ultimately was criminal, but they didn't actually come from outside German society. The big thing that happens to them all, including Hitler, is Germany's defeat in World War I. They weren't expecting it. A lot of research has gone into looking for Hitler's anti-Semitism because he claimed in his autobiographical tract, Mein Kampf, that he had always hated the Jews. But this seems not to be true. He had Jewish friends before 1914. It's too easy to dismiss them as kind of not really human or as psychopaths. They were not psychopaths. They had many of what you might call the bourgeois accomplishments, as it were, typical of Germany. A number of them, quite surprisingly, were good amateur pianists or amateur violinists. And Hitler, of course, started off as a painter. It's only with the Wall Street crash in 1929. That's when the Nazis really take off.
You give some space to Hitler in his early life. Who was he before the age of 30? You go into detail about how he was an unknown. What do we know about him then? And what's important to know about the young Hitler?
Well, the book Hitler's People is based on biographical studies of Hitler and Nazis at every level, from the leading Nazis all the way down to sort of very low-level Nazis and sympathizers and fellow travelers and so on. And I start with a lengthy chapter on Hitler himself. And we don't know very much at all about his childhood. He, if you think about the Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm II, from the moment of his birth, it was known that he would be the ruler of Germany when he grew up. And his parents and other people were constantly writing about him. So we know about him in enormous detail. Hitler was completely obscure. He was an absolute nobody. So his father was a customs official on the Austro-German border, and he just had a normal childhood and was brought up in a normal way, and we don't know anything at all in detail about him.
Let's continue with Hitler and his early life. You give some space to him living in Vienna early in his life. Am I right that Hitler, we now know, had Jewish friends at one point while living in Vienna?
Yes. I mean, Hitler, of course, after World War I, tried to paint a kind of consistent picture of himself looking back. But in fact, like so much of what else he wrote, it was not true. He was Austrian. German-speaking Austrian, but he spent some time as a child in southern Bavaria across the border. And so he spoke with a Bavarian German accent, and he always felt that he always felt as a German speaker, he and the other 6 million or so German speakers in Austria, which is part of a multinational empire ruled by the Habsburg family, that they should really join in with Germany, with the German Empire founded in 1871 by Bismarck. So Hitler was a German nationalist. He hated the Habsburg Empire. He wanted to leave it with all the other German speakers and join in. And he had joined in Germany, and he had his opportunity in 1914. He had already moved from Linz, where he grew up, to Vienna, the capital of Austria, and then to Munich when he came into a legacy from a relative. And it was in Munich that he volunteered for the German army. And there's such chaos at the beginning of World War I. Nobody bothered to check whether he was actually German. They were just glad that he joined the German army.
I know I mentioned this at the beginning, but the book is an attempt to humanize these men who were around Hitler and Hitler himself. And I'm wondering what you think the public doesn't understand, even now, about the humanness of this character from the 20th century that still looms large in people's minds as synonymous with evil. What did you learn about Hitler as a man, as a human being, that you think is important for people to know?
Well, Hitler and the Nazis have been demonized in the literature. They've been described as a gang of criminals, for example. And of course, what they did ultimately was criminal, but they didn't actually come from outside German society. and attempt to kind of seize control of it for their own purposes. It's much more complicated and more political than that. There's a fantastic movie made, directed by John Farrow, who's, I suppose, best known these days as the father of Mia Farrow, the Hollywood actress. But it's called The Hitler Gang, and it was made for American troops going over to Europe in 1941, and 2, 3, to tell them what they were fighting against. And it's done in the style of a Hollywood gangster movie. You know those old ones, black and white movies with Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson and so on. And so Farrow chose lookalikes. He didn't have any well-known actors at all. It's one of the few World War II movies where John Wayne does not put in an appearance. He chose them for as lookalikes. So he's got someone who looks very much like Goebbels, someone who looks like Hitler and Goering and so on. And that is very entertaining, but it doesn't really work, because if you look at them, as I did, and you delve into their background, they're all from German society, all from comfortable middle-class, relatively well-off backgrounds. You don't find any working-class people in the upper or middle ranks of the Nazi Party. You don't find any ex-communists or ex-socialists. They all come from this middle-class milieu of, and they're brought up as strong German patriots and German nationalists and ultra-conservatives. And the big thing that happens to them all, including Hitler, is Germany's defeat in World War One. They weren't expecting it, because the German army and its leadership had deceived the German people. They claimed they were winning all the way through, and it was only in the summer of 1918, as the German army began to be defeated on the Western Front in France and Belgium, and German industry was not producing any tanks, and tanks changed the whole nature of warfare by being able to roll over trenches and barbed wire, which had kept the defense on top, as it were, for the previous 4 years. And Germany's allies, the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Bulgaria, were collapsing on the Eastern Front. So the German army had to concede publicly defeat. And this came as an actual terrible shock to the German people, who thought they were winning all the way through. So that is the big event. That's a kind of trauma in these nationalist middle classes. And as you observed, it's a lot of research has gone into looking for Hitler's anti-Semitism, because he claimed in his autobiographical tract, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, My Battle, that he had always hated the Jews. But this seems not to be true. He had Jewish friends before 1914. He was not seen to be anti-Semitic, for example, until Germany's defeat. And what changed things then was this shock of a defeat, and then the very harsh terms which the Allies imposed, led by Woodrow Wilson, the US president, and Britain and France, on the defeated Germany. These terms are no worse than the terms Germany would have imposed on the Allies had they won. These involved a loss of 13% of Germany's territory, the banning of combat aircraft and a navy, the restriction of the German army to 100,000 men, the banning of tanks, all of these things, and the imposition of financial reparations for the damage caused by German armies in northern France and southern Belgium. So these harsh terms were really shocking to most Germans in the middle classes and on the right. The fall of the Kaiser was added to that, and the advent of the Weimar Republic, so-called the full democracy, welcomed by many on the left, by the moderate social democrats, by working classes by and large, but not, of course, by the nationalist, the ultra-nationalist right. And Hitler then became a rabid anti-Semite. And this is a conspiracy theory of immense dimensions. So Hitler and those who thought like him on the right believed that all Jews, by their very nature, by their essence, by their heredity, were subversive and destructive figures and had to be countered wherever they were found. They're not treated by the Nazis as sort of simple subhumans, as it were, like the Slavs, like the Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, and so on. They were a huge global threat to Germany and to German civilization, as Hitler and those who thought like him felt. So that's a big turning point in 1918 to 19.
You go into the book, you go into his rise. And one of the pieces of that story that I found so interesting was the medium of information sharing that existed during his rise in the 1920s and early 1930s. And you mentioned his book that he wrote in prison, which did gain some popularity in Germany. I think eventually you say it was a free gift to all newlyweds in Germany once he ascended to power. But I'd love to spend some time going into his talents as a speaker. You I think use the phrase a rabble rouser in the book, and I'd love to paint the picture for the audience of what it was like for a politician to rise, the medium they had in which to attract attention and an audience at that time, and what it was about Hitler that was so captivating and spellbinding that led to his ascendancy.
Yeah, well, as I said, I wanted to treat Hitler and the leading Nazis as human beings, because it's too easy to dismiss them as kind of not really human, you know, as devils or as psychopaths. And they were not psychopaths. They were, in many respects, ordinary human beings. So they had many of what you might call the bourgeois accomplishments, as it were. It's so typical of Germany. Music so important there, and a number of them, quite surprisingly, were good amateur pianists or amateur violinists. And Hitler, of course, started off as a painter, not a house painter, but a man who painted quite decent kind of townscapes, really, paintings of buildings, which in fact he made a living from selling them before World War One. He couldn't do human beings. He couldn't paint people's faces or bodies, and that's why he was rejected by the Vienna Academy of Arts that he applied to begin with, much to his disappointment. And he always, in some senses, thought of himself as an artist. So after the war, he joined at the behest of the army. He was still in the army, and they wanted to find out information about ultra-nationalism, extreme right-wing in Bavaria, in southern Germany, and particularly in Munich, where there was a huge backlash against the ultra-left anarchists and communists who'd taken over very briefly at the end of World War One. And he started speaking in the meetings of this small group called the German Workers' Party, and very quickly discovered this talent for public speaking. Now, you've got this is a situation in which there's no TV, there's no Zoom, there's no podcast, there's no internet. There's virtually very, very little radio. German radio ownership was very low in the 1920s, and that's a pretty recent invention, just in the turn of the century. So public speaking, live public speaking before live audiences, is the most important thing for a politician who wants to get a mass following. And Hitler was a very, very good public speaker. Fairly soon, his speeches were kind of introduced by bands with razzmatazz and banners and flags and singing and music and all of that stuff. He always arrived late at a meeting. And then you can watch this. This is a film made by one of the people I discuss in my book, Leni Riefenstahl, where he always begins very, very quietly with long pauses. So everybody's kind of straining to hear him. Then when he's got them all, he then starts to wind up his speech, ending up in an absolute kind of frenzy. And there's a fantastic moment in his big speech at the 1934 Nuremberg rally, which is in Riefenstahl's film, Triumph of the Will, where he's kind of shouting and sweating and showing huge emotion, you know, overcome, and the crowd goes wild. And he steps back and puts his puts his finger on his chin, and you can see he's thinking, "That's great, that got them going, didn't it?" So it's kind of artificial. He's got a few notes, basically he is kind of mock extempore in a way. He's supposed to be speaking from the heart without preparation. That's not true. And another thing he did was he's one of the first politicians to use aircraft. So while the old traditional politicians would trundle around on the train or in a car to a meeting, he had an airplane, and he could go to three or four meetings in a day, thus making it, you know, speaking to many more people. And thousands of people came, particularly in the early 1930s. But you've got to remember here that for all his brilliance as a speaker, he did not get very far in the 1920s, partly, of course, because he tried to seize power by force in November 1923 in the so-called Beer Hall Putsch. And he was jailed, rather comfortable circumstances, because the judge thought that he was patriotic and should be treated with kid gloves, you know, and not for a very long time, which is extraordinary since his tried to seize power by force involving several deaths and a sort of armed clash with the police. But he was banned from public speaking from 1923, from November 23, right through until 28. And in 28, his party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which is an attempt to kind of catch all and get all kinds of people, including socialists, to support him. But it's not actually a socialist party. I mean, it didn't believe a socialist do in the state taking over businesses, for example. His party only got less than 3% of the vote in the national election of 1928. So it's not his genius alone, if you want to call it that, for public speaking. It's only with the Wall Street crash in 1929, which then led to American banks withdrawing the short-term loans on which the German economic recovery depended in the mid-20s, causing bankruptcies, business failures, bank collapses, and mass unemployment in Germany. 35% of the workforce unemployed by 1932. Staggering, staggering figure. That's when the Nazis really take off. But another word of warning, and that is, it's not the unemployed who vote for the Nazis. They vote for the Communist Party, and this is a mass Communist Party. They actually get more votes in the November national elections than they did in the summer elections in 1932, whereas the Nazi Party lost a good number of votes. So the Communists keep on growing. And the middle classes in particular, and quite a number of new voters and some people from a kind of unorganized working class, those who did not belong to unions, they were terrified by the communists. After all, it's in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, the October Revolution in Russia, had been followed by a civil war in which the middle classes in Russia and the upper classes had been expropriated. Their property had been taken away from them, they'd been nationalized, they'd been put in jail, they'd been shot. It was absolutely terrifying prospect, and that's a powerful negative emotion driving people who voted for the Nazis. But also Hitler, then his speaking abilities came into their own in the early 30s, 1930, 31, 32, where he could promise the Germans that he would bring them back again. He'd restore the economy. He would restore Germany's place in the world. He'd reverse the Treaty of Versailles, which had imposed all these conditions on the end of the First World War. And he'd turn everything around, and he would, and I found this on looking at his speeches and writings in particular, he would unify the Germans. It's a big part of his message. And so by the middle of 1932, the Nazis are the biggest party in Germany. They don't have a majority. They only get 34.7% of the vote. So most Germans don't vote for the Nazis. And that's also a very important point. But it's the biggest party, then. They're in a position to form a government.
Brilliant. And I would love to spend some time on two of the most important moments in the ascendancy of the Nazis and of Hitler. And obviously, you're more than welcome to add anything I'm missing here, but the Reichstag fire and the Enabling Act, which I only knew a little about before reading your book. I'd love to put that to you and have you, you know, get some color and some detail there and add anything else that you think is important for the general audience to know about the rise of the Nazi Party.
Yeah, well, Hitler is not, does not come into government as a result of a general election. What happens is a lot of ultra-conservative, ultra-nationalists who want to restore the Kaiser's Germany, the old authoritarian empire, without the Kaiser, who's a bit of a kind of busted flush, but perhaps with one of his sons or even grandson as a kind of titular emperor, or that kind of authoritarian structure. And these people, and I deal with the most influential of them, who was Franz von Papen. Now, I have a chapter on him, who was a Catholic aristocrat who, like, who worked quite closely with Pope Pius XI, because, again, the Catholic Church, led by the Pope, was terrified of Bolshevik revolutions breaking out everywhere, and they put their trust in authoritarian, ultra-conservative nationalist leaders. So they backed General Franco in the Spanish Civil War, Dollfuss and then Schoschnigg in Austria, Salazar in Portugal. And in Germany, they do a deal with Hitler. The Catholic Center Party, which is a big political party in Germany, and these aristocrats and business people are surrounding the president, Hindenburg, who was an old field marshal from the old empire. They put Hitler in power, but they surround him by conservatives, by ultra-nationalist conservatives, extreme conservatives. There's a minority of Nazis in the cabinet that Hitler leads when he's put in power on the 30th of January, 1933. And Papen thought that would keep him under control, that would keep him in check, and they'd be able to use his mass support to legitimize Hitler's, legitimize their own policies of overthrowing democratic structures and reintroducing the kind of old-fashioned style nationalist, conservative, authoritarian Germany. And as you say, these two events are crucial in changing that situation. The first of these is the Reichstag fire. The Reichstag is the national parliament building in the middle of Berlin. And it burns down on the night of 27th, 28th of February, 1933, when Hitler has been chancellor just for only head of government just for a few weeks. It's overwhelmingly overwhelming evidence to show that a young Dutch anarchist called Marinus van der Lubbe had been broken a window on the side of the building, climbed in with fire-raising equipment, and he struck it lucky. He'd already tried to burn down three other buildings in Berlin in protest, as he saw it, against the government's failure to deal with unemployment, as I said, 35%. But in the Reichstag, he struck it lucky. Curtains were set on fire. There's an updraft into a dome, and soon the whole building's in flames. And Hitler blames the communists. Now, it's ridiculous because, you know, first of all, van der Lubbe was not a communist. He was an anarchist. He believes it's not capitalism that's the problem. It's government. It's the state. And he's not even German. He's Dutch. So it's deeply implausible. And there have been some claims that the Nazis themselves started the fire, but there's no convincing evidence for that at all. The Nazi leadership gathered at the burning Reichstag, and it was clear that it was a complete surprise to all of them, but they blamed the communists, a kind of panic, and they persuaded President Hindenburg to sign a decree, an emergency decree, which would authorize the arrest of communists in Germany. And remember, they're one of the largest parties in the national legislature, would suspend civil liberties. And now that was one important step. It's after that that concentration camps for opponents of the Nazis, communists and socialists, began to be set up. And then secondly, just a few weeks later, in March, Hitler persuades political parties who, like the Catholic Center Party, as I said, who were kind of following the orders of the Pope and believed that democracy was a fatal flaw in the political system, would let in the communists, they would vote for it. And the Enabling Act is supported by nationalists and, of course, by the Nazis, opposed by the Social Democrats, who are these middle-of-the-road party, socialist party, but they defended democracy. But the communists were banned from attending, although many of them have been elected to seats in the Reichstag. That's why the Enabling Act was, in formal terms, not legal, but it was pseudo-legal. And that what that did was to give the power of making laws to Hitler and the cabinet. It cut out the president, and it cut out the Reichstag, the legislature. And those are the two formal pseudo-legal justifications for Hitler then replacing conservative members of his cabinet with Nazis and setting up a fully blown dictatorship with no civil rights, no opposition, only one political party, the Nazi Party, in the summer of 1933. And the last thing to remember is that all of this was accompanied all the way along by mass violence by the Nazis on the streets. So intimidation, bullying, beating up of opponents, even in the free elections in the Weimar Republic of the summer of 1932, over 400 people were killed on the streets. It's unbelievable. It was this mass violence. By the middle of 1933, there were 2 million uniformed, brown-shirted, jack-booted, heavily armed stormtroopers who then beat up, arrested the opponents of the Nazis, above all communists and socialists, put them in concentration camps for a few weeks, intimidated them, and got them to promise that they would never engage in politics again, and so they would be released only on that promise. Actually intimidated even some of Hitler's allies, and sort of rather token beatings up and deaths and so on. So it's a kind of twin-track approach. So there's this mass violence on the streets on the one hand, and intimidation, and there are these two pseudo-legal acts, the Reichstag Fire Decree and the Enabling Act, which provide a kind of fig leaf for the Nazis' seizure of power, which is the right phrase for it.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that. And I know, all of this from a man, Adolf Hitler, who you note in the book, I believe when he initially attempted to get into World War One or get into the military, was declined because he was, quote, too weak as a physical man. He wasn't allowed to participate. And you also note in the book that in his final ascendancy in 1933, that like so many other people had prior in his life, he was massively underestimated as to what he was capable of and what he would do. I would love to spend a little bit more time on Hitler the man. Yes. And you go into some fascinating detail in the book about the perception that he wanted to give to the public as this austere, non-sexual devotee of the German people, that he was really married to Germany. But you go into plenty of detail in the book about his sexuality, about his personal life, that really sheds light on the truth of that matter. I'd love to spend some time giving you a platform to talk about what we now know about Hitler and his personal life.
Yeah, well, he always claimed that he didn't have a personal life. He sacrificed everything for Germany. He even refused to take his pay as the head of the German government, although he got royalty payments on the use of his image on postage stamps, so they didn't really need his salary. But he made a big play of that. But if you look behind the curtain, as it were, you find that's not the case at all. Too many biographers of Hitler have accepted his own declaration that he did not have a personal life, but he had a number of love affairs before he took power. And then But most of the time, when he was head of German government, he had a long-term partner whom he eventually married just hours before he killed himself with her, Eva Braun, a much younger woman, again, an ultra right-wing nationalist, anti-Semite, and so on, perhaps in some ways rather a simple young woman. But if you look at the detailed notes that his doctor, Theo Morell, or one of his doctors, kept on everything he had prescribed Hitler, which drugs, which pills, which preparations, and so on, and he kept these detailed notes in case Hitler should die suddenly and he, Morell, would be accused of poisoning him. So it was in his own interest. And to make it all believable as well, he's not lying, I don't think. And every time Hitler was about to spend a night with Eva Braun, he took a kind of we call it Viagra in a way in our own time, but it was a kind of rather revolting sounding preparation made from crushed bull's testicles, which is supposed to kind of gin him up for a night of passion with a young woman. So the point here is that he is a human being. Again, it's one of the things I try and say in the book, you know, because it makes it more difficult for us to kind of understand what it's about. You know, we can't just put Hitler and his lieutenants and the other Nazis on one side and say, well, you know, they're all psychopaths, they're not really human, they're not normal in any way. And we have to look at ourselves and we have to ask the question, what are humans capable of? Excuse me. So, yeah.
Another section that I remember about his personal life, and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, was his infatuation with the woman who would become Goebbels' wife.
Yes.
And that she rejected him. And thereafter, they had a very close relationship, obviously, with Goebbels. You mentioned the theme of musical talent and musical interest in the top brass of the Third Reich individuals, and it was important that Goebbels, who had a PhD, be referred to as Dr. Goebbels. That was important to him. Yeah. To be known. What do we know about that story with that trio and Hitler's initial interest in Goebbels' wife?
Well, Josef Goebbels was one of the earliest people to join the Nazi Party. He started off on a slightly separate ultra-nationalist, slightly more left-wing trajectory, but he soon fell but he soon fell under Hitler's spell and became one of his closest confidants. And Goebbels was having an affair. He was a man of very considerable sexual energies. He kept a diary, and one of the reasons for my writing this book is the newly or recent availability of huge amounts of information following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism. His diaries, Goebbels is one of these compulsive diarists. He couldn't finish a day without writing about it. And his diaries are published in 32 volumes, the last one in 2008. So we know a lot because he interacted so much with Hitler. And Hitler rather fell. Hitler liked beautiful young women, and he rather fell for Goebbels' girlfriend Magda Quandt. And Magda Quandt had been married before, and it was so kind of alarming for Goebbels and Magda Quandt that they brought forward their planned date of getting married. And then there was a very awkward, difficult meeting where it was agreed that Hitler would give up any intention of any idea of getting away with Magda Quandt, but she would be kind of, for display purposes, as it were, the first woman in the Third Reich. So she was his kind of official consort, because, of course, Eva Braun was kept hidden. She was kept under wraps. Their affair did not become public until it was virtually, until right at the very end of things. And Magda Quandt and Joseph Goebbels were absolutely fanatical devotees of Hitler. And when Goebbels had an affair with another young woman, a Czech actress called Lida Barova, who incidentally always denied it, but I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. And Hitler found out, and Magda was going to divorce Goebbels. Hitler was so upset that he basically laid down the law and said, look, this is not going to happen. You've got to give up this Czech actress and you've got to stick with your wife. And eventually they had six children, all of whom had names beginning with H, which is in homage to Hitler. And all of whom, at the end, in 1945, when it was clear that the Third Reich was going to be totally defeated by the Allies, Joseph Goebbels and Magda poisoned them. They killed their children. Magda wrote to her grown-up son by her first marriage that it will be unfair on the children for them to live out beyond the Third Reich, without Hitler, without the Third Reich. So powerful was its grip on the Goebbels family.
I would love to spend some time on some of these other characters who you profile and detail in your book. And I'd love to put it to you for the stories that, in your mind, best humanize these men, whether it be Himmler or Goebbels or any of the other inner circle characters with Hitler. I know there's a story in your book about Himmler in a sauna, I think in Norway or Finland. I don't know if it makes sense to start there, but I'd love to give some space to allow the viewers and the listeners to hear some of these stories as well.
Well, what I want to do is to kind of, you know, demythologize these people. Yeah. These are human beings. They're not gods or not evil gods. They're not evil geniuses. They're nothing more than human beings. And that kind of confronts us, as I said, with the very difficult question of what does it mean to be human? So there was a disillusioned but still active Italian fascist journalist called Curzio Malaparte, who wrote a fantastically entertaining book after the war called Caput. It's about his travels, you know, in Europe under fascism and Nazism and so on. And he is given the job of going to report in a high-level Nazi delegation visit to Finland. And so he goes to Finland. And, of course, the Finns, who invented the sauna, invite him to a sauna. And you can't really refuse if you go to Finland. It's a whole ritual. And so he goes to the sauna and opens the door. And there is Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, architect of the Holocaust, stark naked, sitting on the bench, sweating so profusely from the massive heat generated by a sauna. Malaparte says if he'd waited much longer, Himmler looked as if he would have dissolved into a puddle on the floor. He was sweating so much. So Himmler jumps up, still naked, and gives a Nazi salute, you know, the raised right arm. And the Finnish personnel around in the sauna take that as a signal to begin the next stage, is to get out birch twigs and start whipping him and drive him out into the snow. It's all very good for the circulation, but it's not very dignified. So, and I thought, this can't be true. Malaparte had quite a vivid imagination. He must be making this up. But another set of documents that came out quite recently, just 4 or 5 years ago, was the second volume of Himmler's appointments book, which is quite detailed. It's not just, you know, the actual dates and where he is, but what he's doing as well. And I looked up the date. Malaparte says he went to this sauna, and Himmler's appointments book says sauna. So it's true, you know, he did. And Himmler's, again, sometimes treated as some kind of impersonal, abstract, kind of pedantic figure without many human attributes. But he was. Again, he had a wife older than him, and he also had a girlfriend, a mistress. He had children as part of a larger family. And he did have a private life again.
I know this word has come up a couple of times during this interview of, you know, psychopath or psychopathy. And the idea that I think is very common in America and elsewhere, probably in the UK, that all of these men were classical psychopaths. And I'd love to ask you, there's a book I learned about years ago called Ordinary Men, which I think I've heard you even reference in interviews.
Yeah.
Which tells the story of, I think it's German policemen who end up becoming, you know, basically pawns of the Third Reich initiative. And by the end of the book are murdering pregnant women in the street as the Nazis advance into various parts of Europe. I'd love to ask you, just this is, I guess, more of a philosophical question, but where do you come down on that question? And, you know, I think it's unsettling for most people to learn about some of these stories and realize that these were, quote unquote, you know, ordinary people before circumstances allowed them to have the power to enact this sort of depravity. I'd love to put that to you and get your take on where you come down on that subject.
Well, it's a book by Christopher Browning, who's an American historian who's devoted his career to studying the Holocaust. And his book, Ordinary Men, which came out about in the mid-1990s, describes using post-war trial documents, which are very vivid and lots of eyewitness reports and so on, of Police Battalion 101, which is drawn from Hamburg, the big German, North German port city. And he describes these men as ordinary men. And they received orders to shoot Jews in Eastern Europe behind the front line, behind the Nazi invasion of Eastern Europe, when they came across them, men, women, and children. And it's a fantastically dramatic scene where the man who's the officer commanding this battalion receives the orders. He gathers his men together and said, look, we've been told it's really difficult, but we have to shoot these Jewish families. Anybody who wants to step out of the line and say, I'm not going to do it, may do so and you won't suffer any consequences. And it's important to remember that. The claim that so many German murderers said after the war that I was only obeying orders and I'd have been shot if I didn't is simply not true. But most of them stay, and most of them then engage not only in the shootings of Jewish families they've been ordered to, but then many others as well subsequently. Now, Browning says, so then these are ordinary guys, and it could have happened anywhere at any time. But that's not true. Unfortunately for him, first of all, the German police force was part of the SS by the time they did this. It was incorporated in the late 1930s. The policemen were volunteers, and they had rigorous ideological training. A lot of the non-Nazis or people who weren't enthusiastic enough about Nazism were not selected to join this unit. So it's a German, they're Germans, they're German men. It's not just peer pressure, as you might say, in a wartime situation that makes them do these terrible things. It's also ideology. It's also the training in anti-Semitism and this conspiracy theory that all Jews everywhere are plotting, whether they know it or not, to overthrow Germany and undermine civilization. That's shared by them, by all of them. And the counter argument is that by a young American political scientist, Daniel Jonah Goldhaber, that in fact murderous exterminatory anti-Semitism was kind of hardwired into the German character when Germans started having a kind of national consciousness in the 19th century. That doesn't work either, because in the elections of the Weimar Republic, and I remember, as I said, the Nazis only ever got just over a third of the vote in a free election. There are major parties, particularly the Social Democrats, but also the Communists, who are not anti-Semitic. Indeed, they try and fight against anti-Semitism, though not terribly effectively. So there are big problems with that idea as well. And what I'm trying to argue with that, and I do talk a bit about that argument, about a dispute, is that you have to explain this willingness to carry out horrendous crimes against particularly Jews, though not just against Jews, has to be explained historically by historical circumstances and by the pressures, particularly following the trauma of World War One.
And at the end of the day, do you come down on the side of the idea that these people were simply carrying out an ideology that they had bought into? How do you see that in terms of the judgment or the perspective that you have on how so many people could behave in that kind of a way?
Yeah, well, ideology is very important, and I think it's been a bit underestimated in the past. When you look through all the individuals who I analyze and describe in the book, you find that they are all anti-Semitic. They all buy into that conspiracy theory I was talking about. The ideology is hugely important, and it's not just that. So one of my chapters is about a man called Dr. Karl Brundt. Now, Brundt ended up being a top guy in Hitler's campaign to kill the allegedly inferior Germans, not Jews, Germans. These are the mentally handicapped and the mentally ill, including children. And up to about 200,000 people were gassed, poisoned, or starved by the Third Reich. And Brandt was one of the top guys in this program, which was launched in 1939 with the outbreak of the war. And he was put on, he was a surgeon. He's been described in a recent, very good short study of the Holocaust as a quack, as a phony, but he wasn't. He was an experienced, skilled surgeon who'd learned his trade dealing with mining accidents in the mining area of the Ruhr in Western Germany, and came into Hitler's orbit through his wife, who was a swimming champion and a sort of young athletic young woman who Hitler rather liked. And they were in a motorcade, and one of the cars crashed with horrendous injuries to the senior Nazi who was in it. And Brandt looked after him, surgically removed his eye, which was totally wrecked, mended his injuries, his broken bones, looked after him in the hospital, and was appointed then. Hitler said, well, look, I mean, supposing my car crashes, you know, I've got to have someone on hand who can help. So Brandt was appointed, and that's how he made his career. And it's often forgotten that after the big Nuremberg war crimes trials, in which the surviving senior Nazis were put on trial, there's a whole series which the American military authorities put up at trial as well. There's a judge's trial, there's an industrialist trial, and there's an doctor's trial. Now, eugenics, the idea of intervening to improve the human race, partly by encouraging, as it were, healthy people to have more children, and partly by eliminating, as Brandt did, people who were regarded as weak and inferior. And Brandt could not believe that he was being put on trial, that he couldn't accept that everything he'd done had been a total violation of globally accepted medical ethics and medical norms. Remember the Hippocratic Oath, to do the sick no harm. And here he'd been masterminding at the murder of 200,000 of them. And he went to the scaffold protesting, I've only ever wanted to help humanity. I've wanted to improve humanity. And then the American sergeant, who was the executioner, got fed up with this, popped the bag over his head and pulled the lever. And that was that, while he was still talking. He just couldn't accept it. And one of the most shocking things I found was the fact that these people, insofar as they survived, could not admit to guilt, shame, or responsibility for what they'd done. They either couldn't see it, as Brandt, or they just tried to deny it, like Hitler's Ministry of Munitions, for example, Albert Speer, or the film director Leni Riefenstahl, who consistently denied that they'd ever known about the atrocities the Nazis committed.
Yeah,
I found that rather depressing, really.
I can see that. I think this is a good segue. I know we have 10 minutes or so left with each other. Right. And I would love to bring this back to modern times and give you space to, in your vast career of studying the Third Reich and spending so many years researching this phase of history, which is still less than 100 years, really, from now, prior to now, what warning signs, what you think is important, why this matters for people now to know about, to keep in mind about what human beings are capable of, the threat of ideology. How do you see that?
Well, I think the first warning from history is that we must preserve, insofar as we can, the essence of democracy, of representative democratic political institutions. We have to defend them. We have to protect them. We have to allow ourselves, the public, to be protected from dictatorship, from dictators and those who would harm us. And the second one is that we have to nip racism in the bud. As soon as we see some kind of racism, anti-Semitism, for example, we have to stop it, because otherwise there's a chance that it will develop and degenerate until it slides into murder, cruelty, and torture against a racially defined, allegedly inferior people. As soon as you start thinking about people as not being fully human, which is what the Nazis did with the Jews, the Nazis did with the so-called Slavs, with the Poles, Belarusians, Ukrainians, Russians, and so on, then that's a slippery slope to murder and torture. And that's one reason why I am insisting in the book that the Nazis themselves were human. I don't want to reproduce their own contempt for groups of people they didn't like and describe them as not human.
Yeah. I know you mentioned in the book that I believe the plan, if the Nazis would have been successful in Operation Barbarossa, was to exterminate something like 45 million Slavs. That was a second act that they were hoping to enact for themselves. And when you look around the world today, and obviously we're talking in late 2024 and things are always dynamic and changing, but what are the threats in your mind that you see, if any, to burgeoning racism, threats of fascism? I know you talk a lot about how there are, you know, the rise of strongmen and dictatorship in modern times. And I'd love to put that to you and get your wisdom as to what you see and what you think a lay audience that may come across this should be looking out for.
Well, one of the things about Nazism was, as I said earlier, Hitler was put into power essentially by conservative nationalists who wanted to go back to the old Kaiser's regime, but did not. They were anti-Semitic. They may have wanted to deprive Jews of full citizenship rights, but they were not the kind of people who would create extermination camps and commit mass murder. And in fact, quite a lot of the military officers during the war, and I study one of these in the book, an obscure general, because I didn't want the famous ones like Rommel, called Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb, who didn't approve of the mass murder of the Jews, but were kept quiet by massive bribes from Hitler and threats of dismissal and so on. But so I think we have to be very, very careful about collaborating with extreme exterminatory anti-democratic racist parties. You can see this in Germany. There is an extreme party that's got particularly strong support in the former communist East called the Alternative for Germany. And all the mainstream parties are saying that they are not going to collaborate with them at all in any way. And I think that's absolutely the right way of doing it. So that's one thing. You don't have any truck with them.
Fair enough. And maybe as my final question, I know you've done plenty of these interviews over the years, and I'd maybe love to close with answering any question you've never been asked, or a subject that you still think we get wrong or the public doesn't properly understand about the Third Reich? It's a very open-ended way to close, but I'd love to put that to you to give you space to address anything that's just been on your mind that you think is appropriate and important.
Well, it's about fascism. So you find in the recent U.S. presidential election, Kamala Harris and a lot of other people, including historians who should really know better, have been describing your next president, Donald Trump, as a fascist. And I don't think this is helpful at all. Not that I sympathize with him or approve him or admire, but fascism was the creation of World War One. It was a militaristic movement, both in Italy and in Germany and in other countries like Romania, where which had as its heart militarism and violence. Now, fascists like Mussolini and Hitler were invading other countries. They wanted to create empires. They wanted to dominate the world. And I found some documentation. It actually says this quite openly to his supporters before he comes to power. Germany is going to dominate the world. And so, if Hitler had been in charge of the mob that invaded the capital on January the 6th, 2021, they'd all have been dressed in jackboots and brown shirts and been goose-stepping. They wouldn't have been a motley crew, disorganized like that. Donald Trump, for good or ill, has always wanted to withdraw American troops from the rest of the world. He was the originator of the idea, botched, of course, of withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan. So I think that is that's the first difference, and I think we have to remember that. The Nazis wanted to control business. They wanted to bend, weren't against it, because that was what socialists and communists would have wanted. The Nazis wanted to control business, bend it to their own purposes, and prepare it for war, essentially, which is what happened. And again, I don't think that's true of present-day strongmen in Europe, South America, or North America at all. And it's also important to remember that would-be strongmen and anti-democrats are not necessarily right-wing or conservative. You think of Nicolas Maduro, for example, in Venezuela, who thinks he comes from the left. Think of North Korea and Kim Jong-un. It can happen. It cuts right across the political spectrum. So I think we have to recognize the differences. What's uniting strongmen across the world, mostly, because suppose you have to leave out Kim Jong-un and Maduro, but if you look at present-day strongmen like Viktor Orban or even Donald Trump, it's anti-immigration. Immigration is the main issue, and that's not something that troubled Hitler or Mussolini, rather the contrary in a way.
Fascinating. This was such an honor. I learned so much from researching this conversation, and this has been a real pleasure for me. So, Richard, thank you so much for coming on. It was great to meet you.
And thank you very much indeed. And thank you for your questions. You've clearly read my book, which is great.
Very good.